Blog Talk Radio.
I would like to welcome everyone to John Talk Radio today, Independent Music Showcase. I'm your host, John Darlington. My special guest is Neil Fitzsimon. He's from Fitzsimon & Brogan. Neil, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, thanks a lot.
It's great to have you on. We had such a good time the last time we talked. What I've been doing, Neil, is playing your music a lot. I really enjoy the new album. The latest release from Fitzsimon & Brogan is The Girl Who Shouted Love at the World. And so I don't forget it, the website is fitzsimonandbrogan.com. Is that correct?
That's right, yeah.
Yeah, that's always, I always get good points when I get the website right, Neil. But it's one of the things sometimes where I forget. I say, oh, I should probably let people know how they can get in contact, because what we want people to know through this interview today is about your music and about you and about B and what you guys have done and up to this point. And I always think it's a great idea, Neil, to give that personal side of the musician. They can hear the music, but they get to know the musician a little bit. So what's been going on? I know the new album is out, the single we played, This Is Love. You're talking about a new single coming out. So how exciting has this been to put the new release out?
The new single's done really well. I mean, it's got about 16,000 YouTube views now, which is, I know it's not a fantastic amount, but for us it's quite good. And I think on Spotify now, all in total, our tracks have got about 250,000 streams, which is not bad. So it's been going really well, and we're looking forward to a new single. I don't know which track it'll be. I should imagine... at the favourite at the moment is This Girl, which is from The Girl Shouted Love as well. So, but there's a couple of other songs that they're listening to as well. So, but yeah, we're looking forward to that. We've also been working with Woody Woodman, so he was David Bowie's drummer in The Spiders from Mars.
Oh, yeah.
And also Elvis Costello's drummer as well, Pete Thomas. We've been working with him as well.
That's got to be amazing. I just want to ask a couple of questions. When we played This Is Love, and I've been playing this. Talk about that guitar break. That's such a cool break. I mean, that stands out to me in the song. It's a really good song, great vocals and everything. But can you talk about the guitar break, Neil?
I suppose I tried to do like a George Harrison type thing that he did with the Beatles, that type of thing, just quite a simple little thing. And I think it just works. You know, like, I'm not a great one for, like, you know, going mad on the guitar and everything like that. Just something that serves the song, really. So, yeah, we tried to do, well, I think that was our mindset, to try and do, like, a Beatles-type solo in it.
Yeah, that just sounds so great. It's, like, perfect for that break. Now, let's just talk about the songwriting process. Let's just talk about that particular song, Neil. How did you pick that? And do you work with B on the songwriting process? How does that work?
No, I do that on my own, the songwriting stuff. Then I take it to B when it's like more or less like a pretty firm idea, and I've got the lyrics and everything, and then she learns it from then. Then we go into the production side of it in our studio. But that particular track actually was written for a thing that we've got in Europe called the Eurovision Song Contest, which is a bit of a weird one, because in this country it's a bit of a poison chalice, that competition. People that go in for it, if they don't do well, they're never heard of again. So we got to the semi.
That's not good.
We got to the semi-final, and that was quite enough for us. But what it was, a publisher I was with, they wanted me to enter for that, and could I come up with a couple of songs? And they said, by the way, you've only got 2 weeks. So I wrote that and the title track of that album, The Girl Showed Love, in a fortnight, and it was quite a difficult thing to do, to write This Is Love, because it had to be like a very catchy, upbeat song. You know, there couldn't be any like bitterness or anything like that when you're going into a competition, really, that promotes like peace and love throughout Europe. You can't really start, you know, getting the knives out. So I had to like put on like a happy hat, and then I took them into the publisher, just a rough demo, and he agreed to it, and then we went in with Pat Collier to record them.
That's just a really cool. I can't imagine, Neil, in my own mind, what it would be like. I mean, I couldn't write a song. I could write a song, but no one would like it. But I mean, if I wrote a song that, you know, would sound anything like the stuff that you write, it would be, I couldn't even, it would be great. But doing it under pressure was, it's like when I interview people that go to Nashville, you know, and they become songwriters, and somebody comes and says, oh, we need this song for so-and-so. It's got to be about a truck and a dog, and it's got to be done by noon.
Yeah.
And it's like, I can't even fathom how you would do that. So how did you approach that? I like the idea that they wanted it to be, you know, about peace and love and positive things. So then you're starting. Did you have some stuff floating around your head that you were using, or did you just say, okay, let's go, and as things started moving?
Yeah, they were just written from scratch, and it was done the old-fashioned way. I just went into the bedroom of the flat where me and B were sitting, and just had the guitar and just a blank piece of paper. And always get like the melody first, because I don't think the greatest lyric in the world is going to save like a song that's got, you know, that hasn't got a hook in it. And but it, I suppose the real added pressure was that it had to be catchy. There was no a thing that, you know, like people could grow into. It had to be something immediate. But luckily, I mean, it, you know, when he said that'd be a problem to me, the publisher in his office, I said, oh no. But when I walked out, I thought, oh my God, you know, what have I done? Because there's a bit of pressure with only about 2 weeks.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, no problem.
And recorded. And the other track turned out, well, that's the title track of the album, The Girl Shouted Love. That was the other one I came up with as well in that fortnight. So, it was tough, but I mean, I suppose when, you know, I look back on it, when I first started writing songs, I mean, you know, thank God no one's ever going to hear them. They were absolutely, you know, pretty bad, to be quite honest. I think you've got to go through that, but, I just think it's, I started getting an inkling that I was doing something when my friends were saying that the songs were sounding good, that I was playing to them. And then, of course, you know, I got into a group then, and they all agreed to start doing all of my songs. So I thought I might be onto something. But, you know, at the start, you know, it's pretty horrendous what you have to go through, you know, to get to that point.
Yeah, I can only imagine. Now, when you're not under pressure to write, like in just a very short period of time, how does that process work, Neil?
Yeah.
No pressure.
No, I mean, at the moment, I've got about four or five new ones that are ready to go to be recorded in our studio. So, I mean, we've already got enough for a third album, which I think is going to be out like in the beginning of next year. And we've got no problems with that. It's going to be what to leave off it now. I think we're up to about 14 or 15 tracks already that we've got in the pool for that. And with this five, it's going to be about 20-odds. I just play the guitar every day, and it's just like you might stumble across something, and then, you know, it just leads from there. So, yeah, it's an ongoing process, really. I've always been like that. I'm not as prolific as I was when I first started. It was, you know, it was like a couple of songs a week, but I don't do that anymore.
I think it's got to be emotional, and do you start with, I know you were talking about the melody, but do you start with the music, or do you start with, like, okay, I got some chords, I got a couple riffs together, and then I'm going to lay some lyrics on that? Or is it always the same, Neil, or does it change up a little?
Yeah, sometimes I'll, you know, if I'll get a title in my head, I think, oh, that's a really good title, and then I'll build the song with that and get an idea of what it's about. But I generally don't just write on a riff. I just, I'm quite old school. You know, I mean, I my heroes are like Lennon and McCartney, really. And I always try to make sure it's like got a fairly strong hook in it and everything. You know, and I love David Bowie and Elvis Costello and, you know, that type of thing. I just try to, it's about a proper song I try to write, really, not just based on like a riff that goes on and on and on, like a lot of some of the stuff that's out today. It's just, you know, there's no chorus to it, so I suppose I'm a bit old school in that way, but I think that is the best way.
Yeah, I think it's one of the things where I'm like you, I like to, gosh, I got one, you know, foot in the whole thing just starts with me with the Beatles, with how that changed my whole outlook at music, and how their chord progressions, and how when you throw McCartney's like pop sensibility, and then all of a sudden you got Lennon in there like making fun of the world, and it was like wow. And now you mentioned Woody Woodmansey, and you mentioned Bowie, and you mentioned the Spiders of Mars, and bringing in, I would love to know, Neil, when you're bringing Woody in, and you're gonna, have you played with him before, or is this gonna be something new?
We've recorded We've recorded six tracks with Woody, and we've recorded four tracks with Pete Thomas, Elvis Costello's drummer as well. And I think we're going to be doing more with Woody and Pete towards the end of the year as well.
Do you approach that differently, Neil, when you know that they've got this history? Do you try to wrap your creativity around that, or you just say, hey, this is the song, jump on board and see what you got?
I mean, it was a bit weird, first of all, when I spoke to Woody, because, I mean, such a huge Bowie fan, myself and B. It was a bit, but he's such a lovely bloke, I've got to say, him and his wife, June, they've supported us so much with this new album and the single and the tracks we've done. And I speak to him quite a few times now, Woody, and I've got to know him a little bit, and he's coming down to where we live, so we're going to meet up with him. But one of the last tracks we did was a track called Pretty Blue Gun, and it's going to be on the next album, and it was in a 6/8 time, which is pretty fast, like shuffle rhythm, and Woody, he sends us an MP3 of what he's done in the studio, because we don't meet up with him. He does it in another
right.
studio to us.
Right.
And he was playing it differently. And then B very kindly volunteered me to have to say to him, we don't like it, could you do it again? But not don't like it, but we were thinking of something. And he said, well, I don't know. It was a bit difficult talking to somebody who's played with Bowie, Mick Ronson, Jeff Beck, and all that's played at that Hammersmith Odeon gig, Bowie's Last Stand, which is so iconic. But he went with it, Woody. He said, okay, I'll give it another go. And he said to me later, he said, you did really well. He said, sticking to your guns. He said, because it does really work like that. He said, no, I can see what you mean now. He said, well done in not just like giving in, because you can think that. I mean, they're heroes of mine.
Yeah. So,
I mean, they played on the Gene Genie and Driving Saturday. My God, So what am I doing? But I felt I had to do it. But I was sweating a bit as I was saying it to him on the phone. But he was great about it afterwards. And Pete Thomas has been brilliant as well.
Yeah, isn't that? I think it's really cool because when I've got to interview people that I really respect your songwriting and it's great to talk to you with your experience. When I talk to people that I think that would be, wow, this is going to be hard to communicate to them, a lot of times, Neil, it's the opposite of that. It's like they got where they are by being good people, working hard. I'm pretty sure, now I don't know about quoting when you came to Woody and said, we have to just kind of change this up a little bit. He may have heard that a couple of times from Mr. Bowie. You know what I mean? I'm not sure, but it could have happened. Yeah. And
he told me some interesting stories about Bowie and everything, saying that he was pretty much Bowie, that, he was wanting them to, like the Spiders, when they were doing like Ziggy and all that Insane and all those albums. His patients started wearing thin after the second take. He expected them to have got it down by then. And I said to Woody, what was it like? He said, it got a little bit dark and sinister after the second take. So I think you can read into that what you want. But he said, really, what he did, Bowie, was that he would like play them the song and leave the three of them to work out the arrangement to it, where Mick Ronson was the principal one for working on that, and then come down. But when he did come back down to the studio, he expected it to be pretty much there.
Yep.
So, I think he was used to working with tension. but when I was saying this, when, B said to me, you're going to have to tell him, I said, Trudy, I said, this bloke played on Life on Mars. What the hell am I going to say to him? Do you know what I mean? He's played with Rick Wakeman and Lou Reed and people like that. I thought, oh God, he was big enough. And as you said, the people that we've worked with from the top, I include Pat Collier, that our producer, who's produced a lot of, like Walking on Sunshine by Katrina and the Waves. They're lovely people. And they're generally the ones at the top. The ones at the bottom are the ones that you've got to steer clear of. Really. Do you know what I mean? Really is. But Woody was great. Yeah. He said, and the engineer at his studio, where he recalls it, he was the bass player in the Electric Light Orchestra. He phones up now for a chat and everything, and he's a really lovely bloke. And you think of all the things they've done. Woody was so professional and great with it as well.
Now, when you let's play another song. I would like to play the title track, The Girl Who Shadowed Love at the Heart of the World. Talk about that, because just the title itself, Neil, makes you think, okay? So that's really cool. You've got a girl, you've got the world kind of going crazy right now with a lot of I can speak from being in the United States, and I don't know if you heard about some of the violence that was happening here in the last month or so. Yeah, well, Dayton, Ohio is like an hour from where we live, and we've been there a bunch of times. We have friends there. I've interviewed bunches of bands from there. And it just, like, when you read it in the paper and other people are experiencing it, it's way different when it's this close to home. How was that something? I mean, because my whole thing right now, I'm at a place in my life where I asked this question to a lot of artists about, do you think, Neil, that artists have a responsibility in this world, that art has a responsibility that people have? Because a lot of the people that you would think that could possibly lead people in the right path of love and forgiveness and all these things are missing the boat. Does the musician or the art have any responsibility in that, do you think?
Well, I think it does. I mean, when it's at its best, I mean, when you get like Lemon writing something like All You Need Is Love, I mean, that is just a fantastic song. The one thing I don't like when musicians do it and art is when they get involved in politics, that I start getting a bit wary of that, really, you know, when some of them get very politically minded. But, yeah, I think music has got that. That's the message in music as well. You know, you're not going to get it in rap stuff, anything like gangster rap and all that stuff. But, yeah, I think, you know, if it's done well and everything, it can be very poignant, and it's far more powerful than all the rhetoric in the world. I think you can get, you can encapsulate that within about three or four minutes.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think there is such a power in music and in art itself. You know, you can you can hear something or a poem. My wife is really good at writing poems and writing short stories that there's not a lot of words to it, but they can really make you think. And I just wanted to touch with you on that because a song can change, you know, the way a person looks at life or what they're going to do with their life. And I think that's pretty powerful.
Yeah. I mean, B accuses me sometimes of doing that, of because she gets quite emotional over stuff. And the other week we were recording a song that a friend of mine's going to sing. He wants to do one of my songs, and he's going to go into a studio and record it. Pat Colley is going to, like, mix it for him. And I put in some really, like, sad acoustic guitar on it. And Bea had, like, tears in her eyes. And she said, "You idiot, look what you've made me do." And everything. And that was with just the guitar line with no vocals. So, you know, that's how powerful it can be.
Yeah. Oh, I totally agree with that. Would you like to to talk a little bit about what was behind writing this song, "The Girl That Shouted Love at the Heart of the World," before we play it?
Yeah, it was, again, it was for that same competition for the Eurovision. That was the second song I had to come up with in a fortnight. I think that was the second one that I wrote. "This Is Love," I got out of the way first. And then I moved on to that. And I thought, well, yeah, well, it might be quite a good thing to have, like, this universal figure of this girl that's, like, floating above the world, and she's not of it and everything, with this message and everything. And, this very, like, ephemeral type figure. And actually, the publisher liked that one, that song, more than "This Is Love." Because when I left this publisher and I fell out with him over something, I can't even remember what it was now, I asked for my songs back, and he said, "I'll give you them all back without a fight as long as I can keep this one." And I said no. So it dragged on for a few months more, but I eventually got them all back. But, that was written under pressure as well. And again, it had to be something with hope in it, like an uplifting type message in it. So it was. I think they are much more difficult to write, those songs, than writing something where where you're getting the knife out or you've got some bitterness in it, because they're far easier to write, those ones. But yeah, I think the arrangement of it, I mean, I think it turned out really well. The harpsichord effects on it and everything, I think, sounds great.
I totally agree. Let's play it. This is Fitzsimon & Brogan, "The Girl Who Shouted Love at the Heart of the World," and we'll be right back with the remainder of the interview with Neil Fitzsimon right after this. And you're listening to John Talk Radio Independent Music Showcase. This is August the 21st, 2019. My interview is with Neil Fitzsimon, and Neil is with Fitzsimon & Brogan. You can go to their website, fitzsimonandbrogan.com. Their latest release is, we just heard the title track, The Girl Who Shouted Love at the Heart of the World, and we started off with their first single off of it, This Is Love. And I highly recommend this. I'm a sucker, Neil, for pop songs and for pop rock songs. And
yeah,
although I try really hard. Yeah, and I try. My wife and I have 5 kids, and they're all grown, but they all have their own musical taste. And they'll come to us with, have you heard this? Or you listened to this? And I try really hard a lot of times to keep an open mind and to listen to things that might be a little different. But I kind of always migrate back to a really good pop song, a really good song that just lifts you up. And you know, it's got to rock, though. But in our other conversation, I think, Neil, we talked a little bit about what gear you used and, you know, the guitar and the amps that you go through. And I've been really into that lately, too, because – I've been talking to, when I interview musicians, and talking about the sound. How do you get the sound? How do you know when you have it, and what gear do you use? What are you using right now? I would imagine, you know, you use various things, but what's your kind of go-to guitar, and what do you run it through?
I'd say my main guitar, I've got a Fender Telecaster. I think it's one from the 1980s. It's Paisley. It's got that Paisley pink design on it with a rosewood neck. That's my go-to, and I also use a Fender Jazzmaster as well with a whammy bar. I've actually bought something now that I'm going through a lot. I'm using it now. It's like a Line 6 guitar pod, which is just amazing. I mean, you go straight into the desk with that, and it's just basically an amp with different like sounds on it. It's got about 32 different amp sounds and different effects and everything, and I run that through like an echo pedal as well, or a delay. I've also got a Mick Ronson overdrive pedal, and that's basically what I use for those for all the stuff. And I've just started on the last few tracks, I've been using an acoustic as well, a mic'd up acoustic. I run straight through the pod as well, and this pod is unbelievable. It was Pat Collier who put me onto it. He said, have you thought about getting one of those and everything? And I'd never really heard of them because I'm a bit of a technophobe. And he said, no, they're great. You should really try it. And I bought that off eBay. So it was only about 40 English pounds, which is not a lot, really. It's about 20 years old, this thing. It's not new technology, but it's just absolutely unbelievable what you can get out of it.
Yeah, that's a really cool idea. When you start thinking about, like what Pat told you, okay, so try this and this will get the sound. Is that something that you could achieve without that? Or is it, I mean, when I look back at some of the, we've talked about some of the artists that you and I like a lot, and some of the recordings that they did back in the 60s. And I still freak out when I hear White Room with, you know, the lead break by Clapton and that. And do you think, like, I know Clapton's, do you think he uses other, like, modern technology to reach those things now, or do you think he goes back to the original way that he did it? And do you think the original way is something that people, I don't even know how to say this correctly, but do you think it's better to go back and do it that way, like the way they did it in the 60s and with the limited technology they had? Or do you think it's like,
I couldn't operate one, to be quite honest with you. I mean, I bought a looper pedal and I still haven't got around to working out what goes on with it. But I really love those, as you said, those recordings from the 60s. The guitar sounds they got were unbelievable. And I think, like, with all the modern amps now, you can't really create that valve sound and everything like that. And quite on this pod thing now that I've got, it's got those, it's got a British classic amp sound from the 60s, and I use that quite a lot, to be quite honest.
Wow, that's cool.
I might just have some effects on that, but yeah, I'm not a big fan of all these people that have got racks and racks of pedals and foot switches and everything. I just, as you said, you know, I mean, the Beatles played with no pedals whatsoever when they were first recording, with Vox AC30 amps and everything, and I don't know. I mean, it was the, you know, the brilliance of George Martin to get those sounds, but now, I don't know. I mean, I'm not a great fan of the modern recordings, especially some of the real modern stuff that's in the charts. There's hardly a guitar in sight, and it just sounds like it's played like on a cheap little organ with the, like, you know, this drum beat that seems to be on everything now. So yeah, I like to keep it nice and simple. I like to keep it nice and simple, to be quite honest.
Yeah, I
really
agree
do.
With you. I can hear that, what you're talking about, and I know that it's a recorded sound, and it just, to me, it sounds like, okay, I got to get past that, you know, okay, now
yeah.
I don't really understand why they would use that, other than musicians
yeah.
that told me, Neil, they do it for because they can't afford to get a drummer, or they can't afford to pay somebody,
yeah.
so they do that, but I still love that sound of that warm sound, that raw sound that I hear.
Yeah.
So, when you do you play live anymore? Do you guys do that a lot, or?
No, we don't play live. No, we did all that when we were actually signed to another label. You know, when we were a bit younger, we did all that, and it was something that I think I told you before. When we were signed to our first record deal, we were signed. We weren't a band, really. The three of us, a lead guitarist, myself, and Dee, and they signed us like that, and then they made us. You know, because they thought it'd be good to have like a proper band, so they put other people with us. And to be quite honest, we toured a lot, quite a bit, and did all the London circuit and the UK national tour. But it wasn't something I was really that comfortable with. To be quite honest, I was much happier in a studio.
Right. Yeah, that's what I think. A lot of people have done that. The reason I was asking that is when, you know, what you were using live and how you got that sound, because that's the whole thing with when the Beatles got to a point where they didn't think that people could really hear
yeah.
what they sounded like when they were out there, like at Shea Stadium
yeah.
and these places. And they just said, hey, let's just go back to the studio and people can hear what we really sound like. So that's what
yeah.
I was just kind of getting at. I think it's one of those things where I interviewed two bands a couple weeks ago, Neil, and one of the bands were like a really progressive rock band that were into synthesizers and all kinds of sounds and perfection
right.
and all this stuff.
Yeah.
And then the other band was this band that I've known for a long time out of Chicago,
yeah.
and they're a lo-fi band. They want to sound like that on purpose. They don't want to sound
yeah.
high tech. They don't want to sound. They want to sound
yeah.
like you walk into a basement and that's what they sound like. And
yeah.
the
yeah.
one one guy who was talking to me said, "Oh, they sound horrible." And I said, no, "They don't sound horrible. They sound different, and they're doing it on
yeah.
purpose." Which I thought was
yeah. I love that raw sound. I mean, I really do. You know, I like going back and everything. I mean, I like bands like the Velvet Underground and all those garage bands that came out
oh, yeah.
at that time, and there's nothing wrong with that at all. I think sometimes music can sound too polished, to be quite honest.
I
prefer it a little bit rough around the edges, and I think one thing we really try to get around is that when we're using the drum machine is to get away from that click track, which can really like take the soul out of music if you know what I mean, because you've got to keep it in time.
Mm-hmm.
I know that, but it's really, you know, to get a bit of feeling back into it and not just like play to like the metronome is a very difficult thing. And I think some of the modern recordings sound like that. They sound a bit soulless to me. I don't mind. And some of the Elvis Costello stuff I like. You can tell, like, going back to, like, this year's model, which is I don't want to go to Chelsea on it and pump it up. Those tracks speed up when you listen to them, and it's because they're getting carried away a little bit in the studio, which I think is great. You know, there's nothing wrong with that. But if you go to a studio now, if you don't play to a click, you know what I mean? They just look at you aghast now and say, what are you playing at? Hello? Hello?
Hi, Neil.
Hello there.
Hi. Yeah, just lost connection, so
I
don't know what happened, but we're back.
No.
So.
Okay.
Yeah. We moved into this house about 4 years ago, and it's a big house, and we've had internet problems with it, but I thought I had all my problems solved. Hopefully, we won't have any more.
Yeah,
you never know.
Tell.
Yeah, it's always a... Yeah, but it's really been great talking to you. I really appreciate it. One thing I'd like to ask you before you know the interview's over. Could you give the listening audience just a background of how you where you grew up and what music was influential to you and like how you worked through your first bands and like your just experiences there.
Yeah, well, I grew up, I was born in London, I moved out of there when I was about 14 years old, out to the home counties, more like to the countryside in England when I was about 14. And right from my earliest memories, I can remember my mum and dad, they were both, especially my mum, were Beatle mad, you know, when they were, back in the 60s, they were buying all that stuff, especially my mum. She used to order all the Beatles singles and everything like that. And I just grew up with that, really. And I was just absolutely... Then I discovered Bowie. It's weird, you know, like I like bands like Nirvana and everything like that when they were around when I was growing up. But it was always like bands from the past, really, that I've really bought into, you know. I just love them, especially like the British Invasion of, like, the 60s, like the Kinks and the Who and people like that. And then I decided when I was about 18 to buy a guitar. And my dad, who tried to learn the guitar, said, don't buy an expensive one. So I didn't. And, of course, I had all the struggles that you normally have with learning an instrument. But primarily, I bought that guitar not to really become like a brilliant guitar player and everything. I just wanted to write songs. That's the thing that I really wanted to do, because I was always fascinated with the people who wrote the stuff. And then it went from there, and as I said, you know, I went through that learning curve of writing some pretty horrible stuff, to be quite honest. And then I progressed from there, and then all of a sudden, you know, I had a band around me that did all my material. So I thought I must be doing something right, and then that just like led on to a lot of other different lineups until eventually with B as the single, we got signed to an indie label that were licensed by Sony, you know, back in the 90s and everything. So yeah, that's how it all panned out.
Yeah, that's got to be. I just think about the different, you know, influences that you would have in the UK that a band would have over here, but I think that now with you know, technology, Neil, and with the internet, I mean, everything is so close now. I mean, music you can listen to it, and it's not like it was when I was growing up. It was such a big deal for me to get a record or to get something to listen to. And now it's so accessible where you can listen to anything. Do you think that's a good thing or a bad thing to have this much music accessible to the listening audience?
Yeah, I mean, it is a good thing in a way. I mean, because when we've like signed our first deal, you had to have a record deal really to get your stuff heard on the radio or anywhere.
Right.
Really. So
right.
That was the only outlet. You had no chance apart from that. But now, you know, a lot of people can get this, you know, thousands, millions are getting their stuff out there. The only bad thing I'd say about it is that it's hard to keep a track of how much money you're making out of it, because, I mean, I've noticed that some of our earlier stuff, some people were selling it for about $70-odd dollars or something, and I don't see a penny from that. And also, like, the Spotify payout for streams is what was it? Is about 0.006 of a penny or something, you know. So
yeah,
it's just so. I mean, I just read about one of the writers, and she'd written quite a big song. I can't remember what it was, and she got about 2-3 million streams or something like that. And she made about $86 out of it, which doesn't seem right.
No, it doesn't seem right. And I did read an article where you were talking about Spotify and some of these streaming that they're making quite a bit of money. And it's weird how that the artists, and I don't really know as much as I would like to about this. I would like to get somebody on the show and just kind of break the industry down now. But a lot of people, Neil, will really enjoy getting their music on the air and having people listen to it. But I don't know, you know, I do agree with you. There has to be – artists need to make money off of this. I mean, that's – it's not free to go to a studio. It's not free to get, you know, new equipment. It's not free to tour. So, yeah, there is that. But also, I mean, somebody can say to me, like, at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, hey John, there's this great band, and at 2:01 I'm listening to this great band, and I think that's kind of cool.
It is brilliant. I mean, now for a lot of our stuff to get, you know, listened to by all these people is fantastic. And I think that's what you've got to approach it as, in a way, is that it's a lot of promotional tool really, and you're just hoping. I mean, the thing that we were really aiming for, and what we'd love, we had it a couple of times in the past, is to get something into a TV show or a film. That's where the big money is now.
Yeah.
I mean, to get your song into like a big advert or a big feature film, it's the money is still. We got it into a TV series, a soap opera in the UK, about three of our songs, and the money from that was I think it was about £800 for every 30 seconds.
Well, that's good. Yeah.
Yeah. So,
it's a good way to reach the audience.
Yeah, I think that's what it is. You just pick up on people now and everything. I mean, I've looked at our world thing for Spotify, and people are listening all over the world to the stuff now, you know, like China, Russia, and everything like that. And there would have been no chance of that, years ago, not unless you were with a huge label that had all the distribution deals and licensing in those countries.
Right. Yeah, that's another thing. I never really thought too much about that, about the licensing and how that people can. Yeah, because I know that there's a lot of controversy with the internet right now because it's pretty much there's no censorship. People can pretty much put anything they want on it. And I know that they're trying to fix that or change it. But I don't know how that's going to work. I'd like to play one more song and then we'll come back and then finish up the interview. I really like Smashing Time. Could you talk about that?
I think I'd be better off being born in the '60s, to be quite honest. I really loved all those like British and American films that were focused on like this fake like Carnaby Street that never really existed in London, I should imagine, and everything. But there were films in this country like there was a film, actually a British film called Smashing Time, with Lynn Redgrave and Rita Tushing in it, and I just tried to write a song that would be like a soundtrack to those films, really. That's what I was trying to do. And I was really pleased with the way that one turned out. I think it turned out really well, and I tried to do a middleweight to it, like the bridge section, which was a real like type of like Jimmy Webb middle section, you know. Yeah, because I love all of his stuff. Like, by the time I get to Phoenix and MacArthur's part and all that, I tried to write a middle section like that, yeah, and layer it with loads of backing vocals as well.
Well, let's listen to it. This is Smashing Time, Fitzsimon and Brogan, and we'll be right back with the finish up the interview with Neil Fitzsimon.
I'd like to see that film or video when it's released, if it's all the same to tell you of a girl who played the part. She's got no heart, it won't mean a thing to you. The frosted lens, the glossy covers, deceiving all prospective lovers. Whoa.
I want to welcome everyone back to John Talk Radio, Independent Music Showcase. I'm your host, John Darlington. And we're talking to Neil Fitzsimon. You can go, and Neil was with Fitzsimon & Brogan. You can go to their website, fitzsimonandbrogan.com. Their latest release is The Girl Who Shouted Love at the Heart of the World, and you can get it there, and I really highly recommend it. Neil, thank you so much for being on the show. I really appreciate it.
That's okay. That's fine. It's great. It's been great. Really enjoyed it, John.
Is there anything you'd like to say in closing, Neil, to the listening audience, and something maybe I'd missed that you would like to mention?
No, I think we've covered it. You know, hopefully the people will support our new single. I forgot to mention that Girl in the Gilded Cage from the first album got to number one on the iTunes chart in Belgium and Holland back in January. So
that's awesome.
Quite good. And we beat some, bands like Coldplay and everything like that, and Madonna as well, which was quite unbelievable. And I just hope people support our music, and we're looking forward to working with Woody and Pete again, and I should imagine a new album will be out early next year.
Well, I'm looking forward to it, and we'll definitely like to have you back on. So thank you so much, Neil, and we'll talk to you later. And thanks to everyone out there that supports independent musicians. And everybody have a great day, and we'll talk to you later.
Okay, John. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah. not that clear. Your head's so low.